Good morning. It's great to see everybody this morning. If you're visiting with us, I know we have a couple of visitors. It's good to see the Shields and the Kirchhovels with us this morning. We've been working through the book of Daniel for about the past 8 or 9 weeks. And when we started this class, I mentioned that at some point I thought it would be a good idea to make a quick detour, if you can call it a quick one, into Revelation. And so today is the day that we're going to try to do that. We're going to talk about some potential parallels between the books of Revelation and the book of Revelation and the book of Daniel, specifically to do with some of these visions and these apocalyptic writings that we find in both books. And I wanted to review for just about 5-10 minutes here where we've gone over the past couple of classes, because I think these past couple of Bible classes have been different for a lot of us, especially the week before last when we got into the apocalyptic genre of writing. It's kind of a different concept, at least it has been for me recently, to try to look at the books of the Bible, which I think we don't often try to think of them the same way that we do other books, as genres, the epistles, the books of history, and the visions that we find in Daniel and Revelation and a few other places in the Bible as maybe their own genre in their own right, apocalyptic in nature. And we talked about some of the key aspects of the apocalyptic genre. First and foremost, that when we read these kinds of writings, they claim to be from God. These are not just wise people or learned individuals who are saying, you know, I've lived a long time and these are things that I have found to be wise or helpful to me in my attempts to live a godly life. These are messages that claim to be from God, God's communication directly to man, and that they come to us in a narrative framework, meaning that this is a story. This is a story that has actors in it and characters, and they symbolize different things on the earth. And that story plays out, and it gives us a perspective on how these things affect the earth and the way that they actually manifest themselves from heaven's point of view. And there are usually otherworldly beings. There are usually characters in these stories that you and I have never seen before and probably never will. And oftentimes, the very messenger of these narratives is an otherworldly being. Last week in Daniel 7, when he had his vision of the four beasts, we read that there was somebody in attendance with him as he was receiving that vision that he turned to for answers and for an interpretation. You know, the general thought there is that there was a heavenly being present with him. So sometimes the otherworldly being is the one giving the narrative or giving the interpretation, aiding in the interpretation of the narrative. And lastly, that once you go through all of that, once we read the narrative, we contemplate these otherworldly beings, we have these amazing images in our minds of what's taken place. What is the point? The point is that it discloses some kind of a higher perspective or a greater reality, that what we see happening on the earth is part of a bigger plan, and that God in heaven has a bigger perspective on it than we do, and we are given just a small glimpse of what that perspective is. So that's where we left things a couple of classes ago about this genre. Last class, I confess to you, I felt like I had done a poor job of tying that together at the end of the class. I was fire hosing everybody with all this apocalyptic genre stuff, and at the end it was just kind of, oh. So I wanted to try to tie that together a little bit better by wrapping it up into these two concepts. If you're reading the visions of Daniel, whether it's him interpreting the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, or the vision that he himself received in Daniel chapter 7, or if you're looking at Revelation and you're trying to have maybe just a high-level understanding of what's going on in the book of Revelation without it getting into the weeds on what are these bowls and what are these seals and who is this beast. But at a very high level, you can't help but come away with two key concepts, and that's that God is in control, okay? And the message to us, if we're in the midst of the persecution or the trouble that's being described in these passages of apocalyptic writing, we need to be strong. We need to persevere because we know that God is in control. So that brought us to last week. Just to finish up our review, we got into Daniel chapter 7 and the vision of the beasts. And I think it's fair to say that as we read the vision in chapter 7, and we looked at the interpretation that was given to Daniel, that all the trademarks of apocalyptic writing were present, right? We had the otherworldly beings. We had the greater reality that's disclosed to Daniel about who these beasts represent. It gives him a glimpse into the future. It gives him a glimpse into God's awareness of the situation of his people, that they're enduring persecution, and that's going to continue for a while. But these empires that have global control will not be allowed to last forever, and eventually they will all be replaced by an eternal kingdom. And we saw some parallels between Daniel chapter 7 and Daniel chapter 2. What were some of those parallels that you remember us drawing between the statue vision of Daniel 2 and the beast visions of Daniel 7? Different kingdoms, right? Four different kingdoms. We had four parts of the statue. We had four beasts, right? Particularly with respect to that fourth beast, there were some qualities and characteristics of it that made it different than the other three. It was different in that it had multiple horns, which seemed to represent multiple rulers or multiple kings. Daniel had the benefit of this interpretation, as we read in Daniel chapter 7. So we saw kind of an alignment, right, between the beasts of Daniel 7 and the portions of the statue in Daniel chapter 2. What else? What were some of the other parallels that we drew between the two? Sure. Okay. If you didn't hear Dwayne's comment, he was saying there were also some non-parallels as we compared and contrasted those two chapters. In one case, the vision was given to a king and Daniel interpreted. In the other case, the vision was given to Daniel. And we had inanimate objects versus animate objects. Yeah. So we spent a lot of time comparing those two. But we concluded that the fourth beast of Daniel 7 is the Empire of Rome, right? We did not attempt to name names with respect to the horns and the little horn who was uttering blasphemies. We didn't really go that deep and try to say, well, this horn, these are the 10 kings of Rome that these 10 horns represent. Or we didn't try to assign an identity to that little horn that was uttering blasphemies. And I talked about how there are a lot of theories, there are a lot of views, right, in the world that go that far. I'd encourage you to study some of that. But rather, we acknowledge some of the following aspects of the vision in Daniel chapter 7. One is that Rome is represented by this terrible beast with great power and a multiplicity of kings, a multiplicity of horns representing those kings. And the beast's destruction, at the end of that vision, the beast is destroyed, if you recall, is symbolic of the Roman Empire ultimately coming to ruin, at least in the sense that it existed during Daniel's time, during the intertestamental period that followed on up into the first and second centuries. So there's a finite time period for that. And lastly, that we saw this beast judged in the courts of heaven. We saw it pulled before this heavenly court scene, and it was judged and destroyed. And it reminds us that the ultimate seat of authority is in heaven. To sum all that up, God wins, right? God wins. I want to transition from that into what we're going to talk about this morning. We're going to be in Revelation chapter 13 quite a bit. Before we read this chapter, I want to explain a couple of things. I want to tell you where I'm at on some of this. And also maybe talk about why we're going to do this. If there could ever be a convenient time to study part of Revelation, I think this is it. It's a book that we shy away from. It's a book that intimidates us and terrifies us and confuses us. And you know me well enough to know that I don't like that feeling. I don't know what to do with that. And so having just studied the first half of Daniel and having gotten into this apocalyptic genre, I feel like my brain is primed for this, and I hope yours is too. I've done my best to kind of, you know, suck us all into this. Like it or not, this is where we are. And so we've been studying and thinking about these visions, and we've been considering this difficult genre, and we've done all that work. So let's carry that momentum into something challenging. Let's challenge ourselves with Revelation 13. I also want to just confess to you that my level of certainty over a lot of this is still a work in progress. I have been studying this off and on for a couple of years. I've wanted to study this with you for at least that long. And it used to irritate me years ago when I would be in a Bible class or listening to a sermon, and you'd get to something about Revelation, and we'd all just kind of, you know, joke about how awful this is going to be. Maybe the teacher or the preacher might make some self-deprecating remarks about how they could never possibly understand this book. And it just used to gnaw at me, you know, I don't like that. I don't like that. I want to understand it. And I would best describe my viewpoint on these things as being, if it's in the Bible, then it must be possible for us to understand it, right? But what does that understanding really look like? So that's the part of this that's still forming for me. But I didn't want to just say, okay, it's okay for us to tell each other that we can't understand this book. I don't like that either. I'm not going to tell you this morning that I've got it completely figured out. But I'm on a journey here. I hope you're going to jump on it with me. And as we study this morning, I hope it's the first step for all of us. It's been the first of many steps for me, and I hope that we can continue on this journey together. I want to talk to you in the lobby about it. I want you to pull me aside next Sunday and say, look, I read this, and this is what I see. That's what I want to get out of this. So for several views, my view on Revelation could be described as follows. These beasts and these bowls and these seals and this dragon, these are all symbols that have an identity. And these times and these weeks and these months that we read about in Revelation have to add up to something. They have to add up to some period of time. And if these things are prophetical in nature, and I believe that this book is the inspired word of God, then I need to know what those things mean. Because if I don't know what they mean, then how am I going to be prepared for when all of this stuff happens? That was my attitude leading up to this for a long time. And so I fell in the camp of people who believe that there are specific identities that must be tied to these symbols in Revelation, and perhaps events, so that we can know where it is in history. And we can know how far we are away from some of these things taking place. And today, I would say, I am less convinced that we in the 21st century can confidently assign individual identities. Please don't hear me say we can't understand it. But I'm less convinced that many of the symbols and the numbers in Revelation are to be interpreted literally, and that there are specific identities that sit between us and the first century, where we can start pinning them to the wall, like a detective laying out the mystery he's trying to solve. And several things have led me to that conclusion. One of them is studying Daniel's visions interpretations with you. We clearly see that his visions of future kingdoms were extremely relevant to himself and to those living in the 6 to 8 centuries that followed, right? These are things that were about to happen. It was right on their doorstep. But I don't think that you and I are still waiting for those prophecies to be fulfilled, for the most part. And so while a deeper understanding of these symbols in Daniel and Revelation could be fascinating and interesting to us, I don't know that it would clarify anything about your future and my future today, especially with respect to the beast that represents Rome in Daniel 2 and 7. And another reason is that learning about the broader genre of apocalyptic writing has helped me to understand what the first audience of some of these writings might have expected from them. And we've examined also at least one modern attempt to interpret Daniel 7 very literally and conclude that it's full of unfulfilled prophecy. And we talked about some of the problems that caused last week. So let me just say this right before we read this chapter. There are many, many, many interpretations of Revelation 13 and Daniel 7 that have come and gone over the years. Many of them. They vary widely in which symbols are taken literally, which ones are taken figuratively, and which ones are ignored altogether. And I think we're going to examine one this morning towards the end of class. But to sum up, this growth process continues for me. I'm not done studying. I'm not done learning, and I'm going to benefit from many of you in the audience today who know way more about this. But I hope you'll benefit from the study that I've put into it as well. I hope that we can sharpen each other this morning during this study. And this is serious business. This is God's word. And the last thing I want to do is get even one word of it wrong. So I offer this lesson to you as my current understanding that is, again, still a work in progress. So let's turn to Revelation chapter 13 if you're not already there. And I'm going to read the first 10 verses of Revelation 13. And the dragon stood on the sand of the seashore. Then I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads. And on his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed. And the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. They worshipped the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast, and who is able to wage war with him?" There was given to him a mouth, speaking arrogant words and blasphemies, and authority to act for 42 months was given to him. And he opened his mouth in blasphemies against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, that is, those who dwell in heaven. It was also given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. All who dwell on the earth will worship him, everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity he goes. If anyone kills with the sword he must be killed. Here is the perseverance and the faith of the saints. Okay, clear as mud, right? First question, does this vision resemble any of the other visions that we've studied so far in this class? Yes, it does. How so? What's that? Okay, we've got 10 horns. We've got a leopard. We got the seashore and the vision of the sea and the beast present there. Right? Speaking blasphemies, that's kind of a parallel to the little horn of the fourth beast in Daniel 7. And maybe on a more general level, maybe not just the details, the individual symbols, but what about on a higher level? What are some of the similarities? Yeah. Really weird. Yeah. Sure, really weird to us, maybe.
Also, the people of God are victims.
Okay, the people of God are victims in these stories. It's a story of destruction. It's a story of power and great terror and great wickedness, but it's also a story of destruction on both sides. We've got this beast. He's got 7 heads, 10 horns with 10 crowns. It tells us that it appeared to John that one of the heads was slain, and then its wound was healed. My understanding there, I think the simplest reading of that is that, you know, when you've had a dream, sometimes, I had a really weird one last night, I was telling Jen about it over breakfast, but sometimes when you have a dream, it's not just the weird stuff that's happening in front of you, right? Sometimes time gets messed with. I've had dreams where during the dream, the feeling that I had was, oh, not this again. And then I woke up and thought about it, and I went, that's never happened before. But in the dream, that was the feeling that I had. So it can play with our emotions. But here, the simplest reading of this, I think, is that while John was receiving this vision, it was made clear to him on some level that the head was slain and then had been healed. So either the beast appeared to him with 7 heads, and he watched the head be slain and then healed, or it appeared to him with 7 heads, and he just kind of knew that one of them had been slain and healed. But either way, that's a detail. That's a piece of information that we're given about this beast. Each head bore a blasphemous name. So blasphemy, rebellion, arrogance, and haughtiness towards the God of heaven is associated with all 7 of these heads. And it received its power from the dragon. Now, who knows who the dragon is? Who's the dragon in Revelation?
Satan.
How do we know that? Yeah, and also in Revelation 20, verse 2, and he laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. We've got a we've got to take advantage of those rare moments when we're given some specific information about identifying some of these symbols. Like, I think I pointed that out in Daniel 2 and Daniel 7. One of the things that's actually a little easier on us as Bible students to study some of those visions is that we are given some pretty specific identities in those chapters. Do you have a question? Yeah. Comment? Yeah, that's a great point. If you didn't hear Barry's point, he was just pointing out maybe the comparison between what the enemy is trying to do with this beast and what happened with Christ. You know, Christ was sent to do his work. He was killed and raised back up again. You know, perhaps there's a parallel there with the sixth head of this beast in what the enemy is trying to do with him. So yeah, there's a lot of depth here to this beast. Who do you think is the intended audience of this revelation of John, just based on your past studying of the book of Revelation? First century Christians.
Many believe that it was given to people before the destruction of Jerusalem. And there's differences of opinion on that, for sure. And it in some ways makes more sense if that were the case.
Sure.
Otherwise, I'm not prepared to defend that.
Right. Right. Yeah, but certainly first century believers, we could say, are part of the intended audience. Donna?
Well, I was just wondering, did the people who were killed in the
Okay, perfect segue. So Donna's questions are, did the people in the first century who might have received this revelation and read it, did they already have a good understanding of the writings of Daniel? Had they already read those writings? What do you think? I see a lot of nods. I'm kind of in agreement with that. I think they probably did. And your next question was, well, did they think that the beast of Revelation is just a continuation of what Daniel was talking about, or would they have thought that Daniel's beast represented their immediate future, and maybe now the seventh beast represents the immediate future of the first century Christians? And that is the million-dollar question. And the answer to that question determines which of hundreds of directions you can take with this, and determines whether or not you fall in as, you know, with premillennialist views, amillennialist views, preterist views, and the like. Donna and then Dwayne, did you have, okay. The three sieges of Nebuchadnezzar?
Yeah, and then Jerusalem is destroyed again in John's time.
AD 70, yep. If we're talking about two different destructions, yeah, I know. And so I think it's a perfect time to look at maybe a more detailed comparison of these two beasts, or these two chapters. So bear with me here, we're getting in the weeds. The beasts of Daniel. The first one was like a lion, we're told in chapter 7, verse 4. The second one resembled a bear, chapter 7, verse 5. Then you have the leopard, verse 6. And then the fourth beast we talked about wasn't really compared to any animal that we've seen before. It was just a very terrible beast with iron teeth, excuse me, and it had 10 horns. And then you look at the beast of Revelation, and I'm not going to try to make too much of this for you this morning, but I am going to make the observation that there are a lot of parallels. There are a lot of details of symbols that are present in both beasts. And the beast of Revelation has 10 horns, like the fourth beast of Daniel. It looks kind of like a leopard and kind of like a bear and kind of like a lion. And those are the four specific earthly beasts that you find in Daniel 7. Yeah, Brian?
Is did this beast physically look like John? Did it have the mouth of a lion? So, or is he trying to describe something fierce, frightening, and mighty, or is he trying to paint a picture of something so powerful?
I have too. And, you know, I think either way, if he's trying to just pick symbols of power, it's interesting to me that he ends up picking the same exact ones, you know, that are in Daniel 7. There's another thing I wanted to point out that was kind of subtle here. This beast of Revelation has seven heads. If you look at the beast of Daniel 7, one of them has four heads, and you've got three other one-headed beasts. We've even got the same number of heads in both passages. There's seven heads in Daniel 7. There's seven heads in Revelation 13. There's a lion, a bear, and a leopard on both sides. And there's 10 horns. So going back to Donna's question, and this is the part that I'm still growing in and I'm still trying to understand myself, is the parallel here to help people who have already read Daniel and are already familiar with the identity of the fourth beast of Daniel being Rome, to understand that that's exactly who John is talking about too? Or is the parallel really just to help readers of apocalyptic writings draw some of the same conclusions? Does the parallel go as deep as saying, well, the immediate future that is talked about in Daniel 7 is actually the same exact future that John is talking about? Or is the parallel really limited to just who the beast is, who it is identified with, which is Rome? And that is the million-dollar question, because if you take the view that the prophecies in Revelation are for us, and they're still playing out, well, then the only parallel that exists is the identity of the beast and not the outcome that happens later, not the destruction in the battle, because the prophecy that's attached to the beast of Daniel has already taken place, in my view. Yeah, Dwayne.
You mentioned at the beginning that God didn't write stuff to confuse us. He wrote that we might be informed. I'm of the opinion that when John wrote this, it was very meaningful to the people who had it and read it, and he commended them to get familiar with this writing.
Yeah.
And
not to add anything to it and not to take anything away from
it. Right. And the whole thing is about victory. So it seems to me that John was writing to people who were going to face some very tremendous problems. And he's saying, you know, these are the kinds of things, the terrors that are going to be, you're going to face these, but you're going to win.
So to sum up Dwayne's point, and stop me if I get this wrong, I'm paraphrasing. This would have been most relevant to the first audience. The struggle, the destruction would have been most relevant to the first audience that read this. That's the way I lean on this. The extent to which the symbols in this chapter and later in Revelation have been matched to things that are happening today is almost limitless. Some of the symbols in Revelation are believed wholeheartedly by many today to be Black Hawk helicopters. And I don't mean that I'm not making fun of anybody, but that is how far it can go, is these symbols that were handed off to be read by first century believers have been compared to modern day machines and people. And to me, I lean the other way. I lean that this would have been most meaningful to the first audience that received it. And please, if you lean the other way, please talk to me about it. Because I want to learn from you. I want to see what you're seeing. I want to see what I'm missing. And I'm going to state this over and over. My understanding of this is not chiseled into stone. I'm a student of it. Donna?
Things that happened and were happening to the first century Christians has happened throughout the whole Jewish history.
Sure.
And I think for us today is to know the same thing can happen to us.
Absolutely.
God's in charge.
Yeah. And that ties into Dwayne's comment that the theme here is victory, God's victory. So here's what I'd like to do with the... Hang on a second, one second, Dwayne. Here's what I'd like to do with the remaining time. I want to look at one of, to me, one of the most fascinating and intricate interpretations that I've come across of this chapter. And I want to map it out for you in great detail. And then in preparation for the next class, I want to challenge you all with a little bit of a research assignment, if that's okay with you. I won't be hurt if you decide to pass on that. But I hope you'll do it, as painful as it might be. So we're going to leave this class probably in maybe a more awkward state than we've left some of the other classes. I want to stop after we go through this view and challenge you with this assignment, and I want to pick it up next week because I want to try to pull you into this. So that you can think about it, ponder it, study it, and frankly see how difficult it is and see how challenging it is. I want everybody to grow because of it. Dwayne, did you have one more comment?
One says, your servant act right.
Yep. Revelation 1:1?
Yes.
Okay.
And the people who are making interpretations in today's world, almost invariably, somehow some money
connected. Yeah. That's a great point. I want to give you some citation here on where some of this view that I'm going to share comes from. I went digging for sermons on different aspects of the premillennial view of Revelation. And I came across a series that, to me, impressed me with the amount of research and preparation and detail that had been put into it. And so what I'm going to try to do in one PowerPoint slide is distill about 5 hours of preaching down into one list. And I think this is going to be helpful because I'm not putting this view out there as the one that I've found and adopted. What I'm proposing is that when you take a specific or literal stance on certain symbols in this passage, it sets off a chain reaction of conclusions and research objectives. And I'd like you to contemplate between now and next week what that does to your understanding of the scripture. I'd like you to look for the problems and the strengths with this view. If you take a literal view of the 1,000-year reign of Christ that's described in Revelation, just pretend for a moment that that's your view, or maybe it is. What's the next question that's of paramount importance to you? Christ is going to come back to the earth. He's going to reign for 1,000 years. What's the next question?
Then
what? Okay. Yeah, that's a good question.
Well, also, the only reason he's going to do that is because he tried to make it the first time and he was thwarted.
Sure.
So he's going to give it another shot. Give me a break.
The question that pops into my head is, when is that going to happen? When is he going to come back for 1,000 years? Is there any chance that that's going to happen in my lifetime? And that question alone, I think, has driven some of the popularization of the Left Behind series and others. So when will that happen? Well, this interpretation I want to show you seeks to use all available information on dates, symbols, time frames in the book of Revelation to work out when that 1,000-year reign is going to begin. And based on that information, it tries to do so with the understanding that the 1,000-year reign is going to begin once the allotted time of this beast of Revelation is up. Now, in the passage we just read, you were given one blip of that amount of time. Does anybody remember what it was? Okay, 3.5 years. Well, in this passage, 42 months. The thought there is that those are prophetic days or months, and that if you were to assign the days that make that up into years, you come out with 1,260 years, not 12,000, 1,260 years. So based on the information that we're given in Revelation, the lessons that I listen to make the following conclusions. We're trying to identify the beast of Revelation, okay? This is not an individual. Why do we know that it's not an individual? Because there's no individual that's going to make war against the saints for 1260 years. So that's not a person. People don't live that long. So this is rather a civil or political entity. It's a nation, or it's an alliance of nations, or it's some kind of political power in this view. So we've ruled out an individual, we focused our attention on nations, and we know that this nation is going to war against Christ and his faithful witnesses for 1260 years. And it has seven heads. So if we're not talking about an individual, and we're talking about a nation, and the nation's going to have rule for 1260 years, what are these seven heads? Are they kings? What are they? Under this view, the conclusion is drawn that these are seven successive forms of government. And I'll show you how they get there in just a minute. It is further identified with the beast that's described in Daniel, which we all agree is the nation of Rome. So in what context, in what sense, does this fit together? Well, the speaker that I listened to pointed out the fact that over the period of time that Rome existed from the first century to now, there have been seven successive forms of government, and those are the kings of Rome, the consuls of Rome, the council of ten, the military tribunes, the dictators of Rome, the emperors of Rome, and the patricians of Rome. Isn't that neat that they all fit together, right? Well, I'll tell you, that's what I was thinking as I was driving along. I was going, wow, there's seven of them. That's really cool. I'm not making fun. I'm serious. I was kind of impressed with the level of research that's been put into this. And that's just fascinating to me. Whether or not that aligns with the conclusions that we draw at the end of next lesson on Revelation 13, that's the kind of thing that pulls me deeper into this research. Because somebody has seen something that I didn't see, and that makes me want to understand it more and decide for myself, do I agree with that or not? And please ask this question between now and next week. What are the problems with this view? Ask that with every view that you're given of Scripture. That sounds like it fits like a puzzle, like a key in a lock. But what are the problems with it? Are there any problems with it? And what are they? To finish this up, I have about 5 minutes. Continuing with this line of reasoning, okay, so if we're talking about the Roman Empire, and the seven heads represent the seven successive forms of government, which one of those was in existence at the time John wrote this? Well, when John penned Revelation, there was an emperor of Rome. So at the time he wrote it, the beast was manifested as the sixth head. We're told elsewhere in Revelation, chapter 17, when we're given another piece of information about the same beast, I believe, is what it's talking about, that there was actually an eighth head. The eighth head was a revival of the sixth, or not specifically of the sixth. It doesn't say that in Revelation 17, but it tells us that the eighth head was a revival of one of the other heads. This view continues this line of reasoning and says, okay, well, that eighth head had to have been a revival of the sixth. And where do we see that? Well, in 8800, Charlemagne was named Emperor of Rome. So the entire Empire of Rome, the only time when, under this line of reasoning, that we see one of these types of government being revived would be when Charlemagne becomes an emperor after a period of time when we didn't have emperors. We had a patrician. If you're confused at this point, I don't blame you. I'm confusing myself trying to summarize it. But here's the kicker, okay, in this view. If that's the case, then 8800 is the most likely starting point for the 1260 years in this view. So that leads you to the year 2060, when the beast will be destroyed by Christ and usher in the 1,000-year reign. So it took five lessons to piece this together. They were really good lessons. They expanded my knowledge of how people read and interpret Revelation. And that is really all that the only reason I'm sharing it with you this morning is because I want to get us thinking. I want you to see that some of these symbols are interpreted literally and some aren't by different Bible students. And you might be asking, okay, well, that's really fascinating. You've managed to put an identity to almost all the details of the beast of Revelation 13, but what about the 10 horns? And under this view, or 10 horns, I think I have it written wrong up here. Yeah, that should say 10 heads, or 10 horns, not 10 heads. But under this line of reasoning, those would represent the 10 kingdoms that were divided, and the unified empire of Rome is basically turned into these 10 sub-kingdoms. And you might say, well, where have they been? What's the point? Well, under this view, some of those kingdoms would be more accurate than, or more active in some times than others. And I can tell you that the speaker that I listened to that delivered this lesson believes that Napoleon and Hitler would be some of those 10 horns. And they represent periods of time when that portion of the beast was more active and more destructive against Christ's people than the others. So what's the point? Why did we go through all of that? Between now and next week, I wanted to suggest that all of us thoroughly, on our own, study the beast of Revelation. And try to create your own profile of who this beast is. And when I say profile, when you create a profile, when you sign up online for something, you put in all the information about yourself that distinguishes you from somebody else. So as you're reading chapter 13, get out your concordance, get on BibleGateway.com, whatever your favorite searching website is, avail yourself of those tools, and try to find other passages in the book of Revelation that give you additional information about the beast of chapter 13. Because chapter 13 isn't the only chapter of Revelation that talks about a beast with 10 horns and 7 heads, right? And critique this view that I just gave you. When I say critique it, examine the premillennial view that I just unfolded. I've got a couple of handouts that Jeff is going to pass around in just a minute. And it should have all the bullet points plus these items of this assignment that I'm suggesting. And try to propose some of your own explanations. It's not fair for me to stand up here and give you a view that is premillennial in nature, make some very specific conclusions about the beast of Revelation, and say, well, I think that's wrong, moving right along. Let's think about it. You know, let's talk about it on a deeper level next week. I'm interested in what you see when you read this. You'll find that it's difficult for us in the 21st century to try to place our minds in the same frame of reference that a first century Christian might have had who had already been familiar with apocalyptic writing. A lot of apocalyptic writings came about in the intertestamental period. We don't necessarily have that same frame of reference. We're not as familiar with it because we're not used to studying it. See if you can extract some meaning for the times, time, and half a time. There are three different ways in Revelation that's stated. Times, time, and half a time would be 2, 1, and 1/2. That's 3.5 years. That happens to be the same as 42 months, which is the same as 1,260 days, and it's that period of time is stated three different ways. Ask yourself, is that 1,260 years of Earth's history that therefore has a starting point? Or is it a more general time period? Are there other prophecies? Are there other apocalyptic writings that you and I have already studied in which that same phrasing is used to specify a period of time during which God's people will be persecuted and will end with destruction for those who are doing the persecuting? Like I said, it's kind of an awkward place to end a class. I hope that's okay with you. I hope that this has been beneficial on some level. We built up a lot of momentum just to get to the end and ask a few questions. But I hope that you will consider those questions between now and next class. And next class, we can dig into this a bit more and try to find some understanding for this prophecy of Revelation 13 and the other places in Revelation where it pops up. I hope you'll forgive me if it got too confusing or if it got too abstract. But that's the nature of this portion of God's word, and I want to repeat what I said at the beginning. I still believe that if it's in the Bible, you and I can understand it. That may not mean that we can understand exact identities for symbols that we have questions about, but what it does mean is the overarching meaning that God wanted this writing to have for the first people that read it can still pass down to us. And I'd ask you, as you get into the weeds on some of these symbols, to keep the higher level theme in mind. God is in control. and God wins. And there is destruction for those who persecute God's people. Thank you for your time and attention this morning.